Hey folks, I'm Simon Ward, your host for this weekly podcast. Over the years, I've come to realise that achieving one's goals as a triathlete is not possible unless you support this with good nutrition, excellent recovery, develop a robust framework through mobility and strength training, and have a happy, balanced work and family life. Each of these elements contributes to our race day performances and gives us the best chance of turning those dreams into reality. Each week, my goal is to introduce you to the experts and thought leaders in each of these fields to help you squeeze the most from your life and enjoy racing success. So, without further ado, let's crack on with this week's guest. Welcome to the show, Dave Scott, Mark Allen, two of the legends of triathlon. Thank you for being on the show today.
Thank you, Simon. I'm glad you were prompt on this calling, because last time we tried to set this up in Nice, you were a minute late and we gave up on you. But it's a real pleasure connecting.
I think you'll get a lot better interview out of us. The day we had scheduled was the day after 2 days of pretty intense racing in Nice. Not that we were racing, but we were there working, and amazing, amazing two-day weekend, Ironman 70.3 Worlds, but I feel much fresher today than I did a week ago, let me put it that way.
Well, last week my conversation was with Alistair Brownlee, who you guys saw racing in Nice. He seems to have had a good time there. He said he met you on the Monday, actually, Mark. I think he must have met you just before he dashed off back to the UK.
Yeah, we ran into each other in the little meeting area in the hotel. We were both staying in the same place. And so it was actually the first time I'd had a chance to really chat with him in any kind of length. And he's pretty excited because he'll be doing Kona for the first time. I don't think he was particularly happy with his race in Nice. You know, he just said that after about 5K on the run, his legs just kind of stopped working the way they normally do, which that can happen, you know. And like he said, you know, he was trying to troubleshoot. And then I said, well, that's a good thing if, you know, you get second in the world championships and you're troubleshooting. You know, I said, I know where your level of where you want to be is at. And I know that quite well. So if you get second and you knew you could have had a better race, you do troubleshoot. But Dave and I will be over there in Kona, obviously, in October. And we're looking forward to seeing another one of the greats in the ITU realm stepping up to the full Ironman distance.
Well, and of course, one of the things that we were laughing about was that, you know, age groupers have this thing that if they don't do the full distance, can they really call themselves an Ironman and can they get that tattoo? And Alistair had the same thoughts when he stood on the beach in Ireland and they cancelled the swim. He's like, how am I going to tell everybody I'm an Ironman now? So he's if Riley gets everybody to stand up that's never done an Ironman, you know, at the welcome dinner, Alistair's probably going to be the only man standing up.
Well, he actually is joining Mark and myself at Four Seasons on Thursday night, which is the welcome dinner night with Ironman. So we kind of have a special evening with the three of us. And we've done, this will be the fourth year that I've been involved with it. And, you know, it's an honor to have Mark on the crux of our 30-year, whatever people call that, and then Alistair's debut in Kona.
Well, you've nicely brought us around to the real reason why we're chatting here today, Dave. The 1989 story, 30 years ago, that's anniversary in just a few weeks, since that amazing race that you two had back in Kona. There is a new 10-part series that Scott Zagarino's put together. We'll put the show notes and the links to this on the show notes, 1989thestory.com. There's a few episodes have come out already. There's some amazing backstories, which I wanted to chat a little bit more about. But obviously, we don't want to spoil the whole story. We want people to go along and have a read of that. So let me first tell you that you two guys are one of the primary inspirations why I got into triathlon way back in the 80s. I watched the Julie Moss crawl across the line. It must have been an NBC broadcast I watched on some British TV show. And then I watched the 1989 race, the Iron War, as it's been christened, between the two of you, the only two people that were actually racing in Kona that day, so it seems. And that was what inspired me to do my first Ironman in 1995. And I've done 20 now, and I think I saw both of you there 2 years ago when I did my legacy thing. So thank you for that. It's been a long and enjoyable lifestyle. I've traveled all over the world working in triathlon as a coach. So you guys are legends, and you've inspired me. So that's my bit of hero worship out of the way now. wipe the tears from your eyes before we get chatting.
We'll start with the real opening.
All right. 20 Ironmans. I did 12 in Kona, 2 in Japan, and 1 in Germany. So you're 5 ahead of me. I might have to come back.
Well, actually, I can't call them all Ironmans. They're 140.6, but, you know, there was a couple in the UK. There was the Norseman. There was an X-Tri that I did, which was overnight across on mountain bikes. It took me 25 hours. So,
wow.
That's probably, that goes down as a double Ironman.
I've only done 13 too, Simon, so you're ahead of me.
Okay. I think that's probably the only thing I'll be ahead on today. You guys, I know, enjoy other sports outside of triathlon. Back in the 80s in the UK, we had two great track athletes. I'm sure you'll remember them, Steve Ovett and Sebastian Coe. Both won Olympic medals. The press were very fond of creating this animosity between the two, almost like they hated each other. I'm not sure that that was the entire truth. They did come from different backgrounds. I always used to get a sense in the early days of my experience in triathlon, before I'd ever met you guys, that there was some animosity between the two of you. Now, but I was never really sure whether this was just built up in the triathlon press or whether you were friend or foe. So could you clear that one up for me before we get going?
Mark, go ahead.
You know, I don't think we had, I don't think there was ever any animosity. We just both wanted to win, you know, and Dave was clearly setting the stage for everybody else and showing what was possible. You know, he was basically every year setting a new course record, new world's record when he was racing Kona, almost every one of his wins. And so, you know, we were all just lagging behind, kind of like, how do we catch up? You know, we would all figure out how to beat him in last year's race and then heat up his game again for the next year. And it just went like that. And so there was certainly, you know, he and I had a lot of battles going into 1989 in Kona and at other races, but they were, I think, more fostered out of just both of us trying to really do something that nobody else had seen before. And, you know, his greatness on the race course was what sparked me to really stay on track and stay focused and really try to keep coming back year after year after year. And eventually, obviously, in 1989, we were both pretty much at the top of our game on the same day, which was a pretty rare thing to have happen, I think. Clearly, since then, we haven't really seen a race as close the entire way as what Dave and I did on, I think it was October 14th, actually.
Mm. Dave? Anything to add?
I agree. I mean, I think we had our own little quirkiness and we were depicted in certain ways by the media. And, you know, I was this hermit-like person up in Northern California and you know, Mark was looking at crystals down in San Diego and then we'd battle. And I think there was never, you know, we had different lifestyles, and maybe different beliefs and patterns to get where we wanted to go. But the impetus, you know, for us to train and compete was really sort of the pinnacle, which, you know, over time was Ironman, the World Championships in Kona. And of course, there was other prestigious races, and Mark won Nice 10 times and won the first ITU race in 89 as well. But it was always coming down to Kona. And, you know, I knew every year that when I would step on the island, I had a lot of confidence in myself. And I always felt that, you know, my most formidable foe, again, would be Mark. I recognized the other athletes in the race, but I said, you know, he's going to put one together. And even going back to, I think it was 1984, I always have to reflect back on the time period. I'm not sure if that's the right date, but Mark had a 12-minute lead at Hobby on the bike. And I was getting splits and he just took off. And I said, this is incredible. And then coming back, I heard that we were still 12 minutes. Well, my confidence soared, but I think anyone else who was looking at that race would say, well, Mark has this. It was primarily just, you know, I felt confident in myself. I felt Mark was going to have a, you know, a solid run day. And there was a moment about halfway through the run where I was able to catch him. I didn't think that was the end of our careers and clashing together. And so, you know, in each ensuing year, I knew that the game would be higher and higher. And there was some funny circumstances in 88. And then here we were in 89 for the big battle.
Well, you mentioned 88 there, Dave. You were the reigning champ going into that race, but you had to pull out the night before. You'd been carrying a knee injury. When you, I mean, I was in Kona in, I can't remember what year, it was 2010 maybe, when Chrissy was the reigning champion and had a similar circumstance, pulled out on the race morning. going into Kona with an injury there, when you finally pulled the plug the night before, how was that with the reigning champion? Was that a weight off your mind knowing you've been carrying that injury, or was that incredible frustration knowing that you weren't going to be able to defend your title?
A little bit of both, Simon. People don't want to hear that you have an issue. And as a racehorse and a marked one, people have expectations. Oh, Dave Scott's always going to be on come Kona. And, we just, I'll speak for both of us on this. You can't just push a button and say, oh boy, everything's going to materialize and we're going to have the greatest day of our lives. I was ready to race, and I developed this little niggling knee issue that I just couldn't arrest. And so I got closer and closer, and I knew in the last week leading up to the race that I said, gosh, it's still there. It really bothers me. Every time I would walk, I would feel it. Every time I'd land, I noticed it. And ironically, the day before the race, I tried in the morning. I said, well, maybe it felt bad. And maybe in the evening, one more run, I can test it. And, by fate, it might dissolve and disappear. But, it didn't happen. So, to pull out, and you referred to Chrissy, and I was coaching her then. I remember that day, and she had a whole host of issues. And, you feel this anvil, this heavy, heavy, heavy blanket of, should I pull out? Do I really need to pull out? People have expectations. I have expectations. And I think any athlete that has an off day but doesn't even step up to the starting line, it's kind of overwhelming psychologically that you've not only let yourself down, but you let down all the people that have supported you. So it was a big decision, but it was the right decision.
Mark, you had clearly come into that race then with a race plan that was going to be you and Dave. So then when that particular part of your race plan had been removed, how what went through your head then?
Well, I actually went into 1988 pretty, I wouldn't say lackadaisical, but I wasn't really that hopeful. I'd been there five times. This was going to be my sixth Ironman. I'd had a number of races there where I'd been in the lead and then fell apart on the run and Dave would win. And I hadn't really changed anything about my training in 88. And so I went into the race kind of like, okay, I'm going to try again, but I don't know how I'm going to turn this thing around and come out on top. And then, when I got the news that Dave had actually pulled out of the race, it's like, talk about a cloud being lifted. It was like, dun, da, 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 the cloud breaks and the sun just come out, because I looked at everybody on the list who was racing and I had beaten all of them. And I thought, okay, this is my year. Well, as it turned out, it wasn't my year. I ended up getting three flats on the bike. I had two spares. And that third one cost me just a huge amount of time waiting for the support vehicle to come with another wheel. And so I ended up finishing in fifth that year, farther out of the lead than any of the other races I'd finished there. And so I just thought, I am cursed in this race. There's something wrong. At that point, I didn't want to go back. I was so disappointed, and I thought, Dave pulls out, it's my race to win, and I still can't win it because of flat tires. And those were the only three flat tires I got the entire time that I have ridden my bike on the Big Island. So it's like something wasn't working. And so, that's actually the beginning point of the 10 stories that Dave and I are putting together. Scott Zagarino, my longtime friend, has known Dave and I for many years. He's my business partner. He said, there's some stuff that you guys haven't talked about that I know, and that you've probably only told your close friends and family, that made it almost impossible to actually bring the two of you together in the condition that you were in 1989 in October. There were so many personal obstacles you had to overcome. You finished the year in 1988 thinking, I am never going back to that race. So at that point, there was going to be no 1989 matchup. And Dave, he can tell his side of it, but I think that actually even sparked him to be more motivated, to be even more fit. And of course, as the year went on, then he had his challenges it's this series is something that we both, we're not writing it for our own, to pump ourselves up. It's more like to just give people an insight into what it really took for both of us to overcome the things that are challenges that every athlete has, that every person has, to get to a point where they can put something together in their life that they're really proud of and that they know is the best that they can do. And so we're actually at this point, late September, halfway through that series. We're posting one a week for the next for 5 more weeks every Thursday, and people can, as you mentioned earlier, read those at 1989thestory.com. I'm learning a lot about Dave that I never knew before. and actually what it's done is it's just helped raise my respect for him even more, because I looked at Dave as just this unbeatable sort of, like I said at one point, a steam engine without brakes. You know, once he gets going, there's no stopping him. And I realized that there were a lot of things that he struggled with that year to keep pulling himself back together after some, you know, personal things in his life that are stuff that we all have to deal with. And so I think it really humanizes greatness for other people. And I think it hopefully gives people hope that you don't have to be this, you know, superhero kind of person. Every human being can do something amazing if you overcome your challenges, if you keep going, if you find the solutions, if you don't give up. And you know, it's just, that's what's been great about putting these together. I can't wait to read Dave's next 5 also.
Well, you know, Mark, you got the nickname of the Grip. I presume that, did that develop after 1989 as you sort of had that iron clasp on the Kona race, or was that developing before then?
That actually started before then. There was a year around 1985 where I really made a jump in my cycling, and I did a lot of group workouts together on the bike. I wasn't a solo trainer as much as Dave was. And so it was before clip-ons, and there was one group ride we were on, and you know, everybody's goofing around chatting, and I just got down in the drops right in the beginning, and I just took off, and somebody goes, "Watch out, he's got the Grip, hold on, here we go." And it just stuck. And so it was kind of a fun nickname to have.
Okay. So Dave, you were known as the man. I think actually yours, as well as being the inspiration through that 1989 war, I actually bought your book, Dave Scott Triathlon Training. I tried to do your training sessions in there, it wrecked me, I might say. But you had this nickname as the man, and as Mark said, you had that iron grip on Kona through the 80s. And but as Mark said, you weren't this, you know, superhero without weaknesses and frailties. But I don't think anybody's ever heard about those. Can you share any of them?
Well, Mark sort of alluded to it. I think everyone sort of looks at us, and certainly because I was semi-isolated at the time, quite a ways north from the rest of the boys in San Diego, and people said Dave Scott chooses to be in this his hometown of Davis, and I, you know, my choice, it was my hometown, and I have friends there, and that's where I train, and I developed a willingness and a perseverance to train by myself because there weren't any other triathletes. You know, I was the one. I didn't really have a mentor. I didn't have a group. There was a cycling club and it was an active town, but it was 99% was by me. And then a close mate of mine, Mike, who coerced me into doing the first Ironman race way back in 80. He said, "Oh, you got to do this thing. This is built for you." This is 1979. So, you know, in this, 89thestory.com, that we've kind of opened ourselves up. Mark and I didn't really talk about this race, and Bob Babbitt said, I think it was Los Angeles, we had kind of a joint gathering, the three of us, with the LA Tri Club. And that was the first time that I heard some different nuggets that Mark exposed, but nowhere near the exposure that we have kind of divulged into our lives. One of the vulnerabilities that I had, and I've recognized this with other athletes and other entertainers, is that there's a high level of depression that permeates those two industries. And I had depression. I'm aware of it. I wrestle with it all the time. I know how it manifests itself. And several of the chapters in this story are those vulnerabilities that here I'm writing down. Well, of course, my family knows about them because they had to buoy me. They had to get me back up even during 89, many, many times. And so all of a sudden now I'm putting pen and paper to this and I'm exposing this to the world. You know, I feel at times, gee, I've kind of let this out. does that weaken the event? Is it an excuse? Is it none of the above? It's really what Mark alluded to, sort of the humanistic side of both of us, that, you know, we do have vulnerabilities. Where they are different. You know, Mark kind of looking at Ironman and saying, gee, I don't know if this race is for me. I feel like there's a curse. And for me, I just felt like every time I'd go into that race, I was ready. But to get ready, people forget about those many, many, many dark days that we all have. And I had a lot of them. And I kind of alluded to this, which I guess encourage people to read, is that I wouldn't wake up every day and say, oh boy, here I go. I get to train by myself. I wonder what Mark is doing. He's probably on his game today. I mean, I had a lot of days where it was all or nothing. It was kind of like an alcoholic. Either you drink the whole bottle or you wouldn't drink any of it. And my training was the same way. If I had a 15K run, I'm just pulling a number out of the air, and all of a sudden I whittled away time and could I do 10K? No, I wouldn't. It was zero. So it was sort of a self-inflicting psychological punishment. And I think a lot of athletes go through this. I felt compelled to write about it.
It's a very topical subject you bring up, because mental health now in the workplace and in the sports place is becoming a much bigger subject, certainly in the UK. I don't know about in the US, but and it's always very refreshing for the age group athletes and the recreational athletes to hear that the people they put on a pedestal that they think are indestructible actually have the same frailties, the same as Alistair standing on the start line and saying, am I going to be able to call myself an Ironman? Which is a conversation that all of those first timers have. You know, and I guess I recognize also that it was probably in the position that people had put you in, and you perhaps created for yourself, it was probably quite difficult for you to be open and public about it as well.
Very, very much so. As I started writing, and you know, I just write down a few notes, and Mark's he seems to pump these out. I kind of look at my paper for 2 hours, and then I start writing one line. I scratch that one out and try the next one. And again, it kind of comes back to, how much do I want to divulge? You know, people have heard the story about the race through other people's eyes, not ours. And we are getting to that. And so, you know, I know both of us are going to say things in the race that you don't know about. And again, it's not sour grapes. It's just the attitude and the mindset as the race unfolded, what really happened. Mm-hmm. And so as you were alluding to this, you know, this whole mental health issue is a gigantic one. And, you know, we certainly read about it in the States, we read about it worldwide.
Let's go to 1989 now. So Mark, talking of not wanting to do Ironman anymore, you did pretty well in Avignon. You actually beat a friend of mine, Glenn Cook, into second place there in the inaugural ITU World Championships. So, but that's unusual. Nobody'd be able to do that these days, winning an ITU short course, right? Standard distance race, and then hop into Ironman 2 months later. So, what happened? What did you do different about your training to prepare for that? And what did you do in the two months afterwards? Because I think that race was probably in August, was it, in 1989?
Yeah, the ITU, first ever ITU Olympic Distance World Championship, Avignon, France, August 6th, I think, 1989. It was the first time that every short course specialist in the world got together for one race. And you had to make your country's team. So it was either one, two, or three athletes per team based on country's allotment and all that kind of stuff. So it was a race like I had never experienced before. And my training for it actually started in early June, right after Dave and I had a pretty strong clash at the World Cup Triathlon on the Gold Coast. It was a long distance race, about around 6 hours, 5.5, 6 hours. And so after that event, which I had been training for, and then I went to Nice, and then after Nice, I completely cut out Ironman training. And it was, I'm not a good multitasker, you know, so I know that I can't keep thinking about Kona and then keep and think about Avignon. I had to like compartmentalize it. And so for almost 2 months, I just completely shut out Ironman, because you have to understand, at that point of my career, I didn't know that this battle was going to take place in October. You know, all I knew was that I'd been to Hawaii 6 times and never won. And I had actually won quite a few short distance, Olympic distance races in my career. So I thought, let me just devote everything to Avignon here and see if I can win that. And then at the end of the year, I can make my decision. Maybe I will focus on Olympic distance racing and just say, forget Ironman. It's not for me. That may have been a mistake, because you take 2 months away from kind of keeping on that endurance fitness that I'd gained. If I let it go in exchange for speed, after I get back from Avignon, there may not be enough time to get ready for Kona. But I just needed a mental break from it. You know, as Dave has alluded, there's a lot of pressure on the top athletes pretty much every day of the year when you decide I'm going to go to Kona and I'm going to try and be first, second, top five, whatever it is. It's in the back of your mind. And I was starting to feel this vulnerability. Like I can't hold that pressure anymore. And so I just turned it off. I said, Dave, you can have it. You know, once again, I was kind of thinking, I don't even know if I'm going to go to Kona after, I'll see how I feel after Avignon. And so anyway, it turned out to be a great race. I had a very lousy swim. I had a mediocre bike and then an amazing run, and ended up actually in midway through the run taking the lead and holding it. And it was really pretty cool to be the first to do something like that. And you know, on stage at the awards, it was me and Glenn Cook and Rick Wells. And so it was, you know, and the flags go up and they play the national anthem. And it was the only race I've ever been at where they played the national anthem. And, you know, I'm not like a nationalistic kind of guy, but it just made me feel kind of proud, like, wow, this is something special. And I'm really glad that I got to experience it. And then the next day it was like, okay, that's done. Now what? Am I going to pull it together? Am I going to do what it's going to take now in the next 2.5 months to actually show up in Kona and do something different than had happened in those last 6 years? And so it was, again, it was another point of reflection, like, whew, okay, I think I need to try. But I also knew that I was actually starting to get a little bit tired in a sense, because that took a lot of focus to get ready for Avignon. You know, you don't get a world championship free. You know, there's a cost to it.
Dave, you weren't exactly idle during this phase of Mark's short course racing, were you? I know you were training on your own, but you had this little event in Japan that seemed to go pretty well. You broke the world record. You almost became the first man to go sub 8 hours. It seems ridiculous to me that you could put in such an amazing performance and then get ready for Kona a couple of months later. You know, did it not take a lot out of you, or was it just one of those days where you floated along and had a great performance and recovered really quick?
Japan, Ironman Japan was a commitment that I'd made in late 88. And just going back after pulling out of the Ironman, the next day I said, I've got to come back in 89, contrary to what Mark had just said. During that time, November, December, somewhere in there, I got an invitation to come to Ironman Japan. I did it in 1985 as well, and had a solid race in 85. And I said, I think I can do two. I don't know what I was thinking at the time. I said, well, why not? So I didn't race Kona in 85. I got married in October of 85. I'm not really sure why I did that. But
Married or racing?
Yeah, getting married. Yeah, at that time. I mean, there was a lot of pluses behind that. I mean, I got three great kids. So committing to Ironman Japan late 88, you know, it was, of course, on my radar. And then my wife at the time, Anna, said, well, I'm pregnant shortly after that. And I said, oh, gosh, what are we guessing is the due date? Oh, around the 1st of August, which was similar to Mark. I mean, you know, I went over to Japan to race the big race. So I was thinking about, she's now in her 9th month and about ready to pop. I get on the plane to go to Ironman Japan. I'm thinking, this is my first child. I want to be there. I felt going into the race, my preparation had been good throughout 89. And I thought, well, I'm going to have a solid race. But really, my mindset was on this new baby that was going to be born. So I in doing the race, I didn't really know my times or anything. I had the lead kind of right away, got out of the swim, and then was able to get away on the bike, and felt like I had a solid bike. And then on the run, the weather started changing. This typhoon was coming in, and I was just ahead of it. It was humid, but I'll say relatively cool day. And I saw the pace clock for the first time, or at least it registered the first time. And I did some math thinking at the end, I said, gosh, if I can run this fast, I'm going to be maybe under 8 hours. And so that was kind of my goal. But really, that coming in 8:01, it knocked off a lot of time from what I had done at Kona prior to that in any other race worldwide. There weren't these super fast Ironmans that there are now. I kind of just wanted to get back on the plane and come back home to witness the birth of the child. So it was a great day. But then, like Mark, after I finished that race, I was mesmerized by Ryan, my son, who was born 2 days later. And that kind of curtailed the buildup to Ironman Kona in October.
I mean, you two guys have got coaching businesses. You know, those sorts of preparations, having your first child, going to Japan, and there's a lot of long-haul travel there, going to Europe, Martin, coming back. They're not exactly the preparations that you'd recommend to your athletes.
No, not at all. Simple statement. Don't do that.
Do as I say, not as I do, the little mantra that hangs above every coach's bed. So let's talk about 1989 then. Just an observation. I sort of, you know, playfully mentioned earlier that you two were the only people taking part in the race. Of course, you weren't. I looked at the top 10. That top 10 was a stacked field. I mean, Greg Welsh was second. Mike Pigg.
He was actually third.
Oh, yeah. Mike. Yeah, Greg Welsh. He was. You're right. Greg Welsh.
Yeah, Dave and I were first. Yeah. Greg Welsh was second.
Yeah, I wonder if you'd been holding hands crossing the finish line if you'd both have been disqualified.
Oh, boy.
I don't think we'd be holding hands. That wasn't intention.
So, Greg Welsh, 23 minutes behind. You know, I mean, he's another legend of sport. Mike Pigg was one of the big group of five of you around there. Kenny Glar, who's probably still going to be competing this year, 75 years after his debut. Paolo Chiuru, Scott Tinley, Jürgen Zach, Yves Cordier, Mark, your sort of perennial nemesis in Nice, and Ray Browning, and Rob Burrell, who's still going strong, and Wolfgang Dietrich. And I watched the little video on YouTube of Wolfgang Dietrich. He actually led the race until about mile three of the run, and you two ran past him. And what I thought was so funny, I don't think you planned it, but you ran either side of him, and he looked like you just picked his pocket. Where do they come from? I'll put the link to that on the show notes, because it's quite a funny moment. But Mark, was your strategy to shadow Dave every single minute of the way and just break him at the end? And did you have a plan of where that was going to happen?
I did have a strategy to just stay with Dave as long as I could until it felt like there was a point where maybe I could pull away very late in the race. You know, I had tried a couple different strategies. As Dave said, in 84, I was about 12 minutes ahead off the bike, ran through town thinking I got this thing, and got to the top of Palani Hill, went out onto the Queen K, and all of a sudden I felt like my gas tank had been emptied, and I knew that I would just be walking at some point. Dave won that year. 87, I was with 10 miles to go, I had a 5-minute lead on the marathon. And, you know, I thought, okay, I'm patient enough this year. And at the point that I pulled away, started putting time on him, I thought, I've got it. And of course, then once again, I started walking. And, you know, Ironman has never been won by a guy walking the marathon, just so you have that in your mind. And so this year, I thought, in 89, I thought, I thought, Dave knows how to pace this thing. He knows how to pace it better than anybody else on this planet. I don't know how to pace it. Let me just see if I have the strength and every stamina to stay with him. Just stay with him until very late in the marathon, and then see how it pans out. I didn't have a real plan on, okay, I'm gonna pull away on the last hill. You know, that was something that completely evolved as the race went on. But it was really, you know, well, there's a lot of details that we'll both share about this race, but you know, one of them, for me, the hardest part of that day was not being patient, but just feeling Dave's strength. You know, when you're in a race like that with somebody, your awareness shifts, you know, and you can really sense how the person is feeling. I didn't have to say, hey, Dave, are you strong now? Are you feeling weak? Are you tired? What's going on? You can sense it, you know, and I could just tell that he was so solid and there was no trick or surge or thing that I could do that was going to intimidate him to just throw in the hat and give up. That was not going to happen. And so I realized I'm going to have to just completely outrace him somehow. And that was a completely overwhelming concept because I had never been able to do that before. And I didn't know how it was going to happen on that day.
I know when I run, Dave, and I've got somebody right on my shoulder and they're breathing and I can hear their footsteps, I'm sort of tempted to turn around and go like, can you just stop making so much noise or just go ahead for a bit? When you watch that video, Mark was right there, step by step, never really getting ahead of you, either right by your side or just behind you. Did you ever get any sense of irritation at all during that run?
I'll back up just for a second on this assignment because on the bike leg, Wolfgang was always in the lead. I was aware of his margin. It was a minute 30, and I think it went up to 3 minutes, and then we whittled it down a little bit. And as you alluded to, we caught him at 3 miles on the run. You know, I'm thinking I've led this race many, many times, and have certainly been able to override anyone on the marathon. So I was thinking, gee, I'm going to catch Wolfgang. I was not worried about him as being a factor on the run because he has had difficulty, at that distance. But I still wanted to, the lure was there. I wanted to catch him. Mark was behind me the whole time, and I was completely unaware of the string of other athletes that were always behind. It was over a decade later that I realized that Mike Pigg and Kenny Glaw were in that group, but yet Mark nor anyone else ever came ahead of me. And I, to this day, I was kind of befuddled by that. But I think a lot of them, as Mark maybe alluded to, is that I'd figured out the puzzle. So therefore, I'm just going to shadow Dave and see how he does on the bike and I'll be right there. I would have liked to have seen Mark. I see people running or riding their bikes. I'm always picking on their biomechanics. And what you said, Simon, they're breathing too hard or they're listing some way or they're the symmetry is a little bit off and their pedal stroke or whatever you discern, I can see those little nuances. So I would have liked maybe to see Mark come ahead, but at the same time, just thinking about it now, I think, well, maybe that'd be disconcerting if he came by me. I think, well, geez, he's roaring along now. And at that moment, I'm struggling a bit. When we got to the run, I anticipated that we would be side by side. Simultaneously, I felt as though if I took the race out hard, my legs felt pretty good right away, that let's just see what happens. Let's see if he can hold the pace as we went through town. And as you know, Simon, with your experience, running along the Elite Drive is difficult. It has a lot of ups and downs. It's quite hot and humid because there's very little airflow from the condos that are along the waterfront. So you're kind of engulfed with the people yelling at you, but you better be paying attention to how you're feeling. Mark's right next to me. And there are several things that happened in the dynamics, even on Elite Drive as we were side by side. I didn't find it disconcerting, but I felt, there would be a moment where I'm going to break him down and he's going to falter. And I'm going to sense that. And maybe it's a drop back of 2 or 3 meters, or it's a breathing rate, or it's something that gives me an indicator that he's having a little more trouble, and that's the point that I need to pounce. But I did have a strategy if we were together near the end.
We'll come to that in a moment. You talked about running along Lee Drive. Of course, the run back then, the transition two wasn't where it is now. It was up at where the Sheraton is now, I think, so right up in Kiahu. And they had this thing called the Pit, which most people might have heard of. I should imagine a lot of people that are listening to this are newcomers to Ironman and perhaps don't know of the history going back that far. So you ran out of the Pit and then you only ran one way down the Leahy Drive all the way, but you didn't go to the end. You didn't go down into the Energy Lab, did you? I think you turned on the highway just before the airport and then came straight back. Do you think the run course now is easier than it was then when you had to do the Pit?
In 89, if my recollection is there, we did not do the Pit. We came straight up the hill.
Oh, okay.
And we made an immediate left on Elite Drive. Mark, is that correct?
That's what we did, yep.
Uh-huh. So the Sheraton's at the bottom of quite a stiff hill. So you come out of T2 And you're straight into what, a 10% grade?
Yeah, a little bit greater than that. People have said it's 12%. So it's a pretty gnarly pitch right at the outset. And it continues to go up for another 600 or 700 meters until you kind of have the descent. Yeah, so the first part is a bit humbling, certainly not a rhythmic type of a run, but you have to be aggressive enough going up that hill. At least I felt I needed to. And then along the Lee Drive, as I alluded to, it does have a lot of ups and downs. It's not just a flat strip.
So do you think that what I'm coming to is comparison with how long it took for anybody to beat the times that you two had done? But we're not comparing like for like. So the run course now, it goes into the Energy Lab and back out, and that's sort of 2 miles down a slight gradient back up. But they don't have to do that bit at the other end of the Leahy Drive. So harder or easier now?
Well, I think the other part that was difficult for a lot of athletes is that we ran about a mile and a half or somewhere maybe 1.3 or 4 beyond the airport. So we've now exceeded the Energy Lab by another mile of the airport plus a mile and a half. That's 5 miles getting back to the Energy Lab, and it has undulations as well. As you're flying in there, you're at a pretty high point at the airport if you look down at the sea. So I think the psychological part, when we made that turn well beyond the airport, we have 10 miles to go. And that's the 16-mile mark, 10 to go. And if people were able to run well to that point, as Mark and I were running solidly, I said, okay, now the race has begun.
Somebody that I heard is going to be doing some kind of a true sort of topographical analysis of the two different courses, just to see is one more difficult just purely from a amount of time, elevation gain and loss, all that. But I think Dave really hit it on the head. When you have to run out to the airport and then keep going for another almost mile and a half, you feel like you are running to the edge of the earth. Mm-hmm. And there was a big giant inflatable Bud Light can that stood out, and you could see this thing forever on the Queen K as you're heading out, and it seems like it's never getting closer. And so I can't say for sure if one course is more difficult technically than the other one or slower or faster, but I know that for sure, I've done all of the different courses except for a slight change that they have now, but for sure, I think having to run out way out past the airport psychologically was much, much more difficult than when you are able to go down into the Energy Lab and you just don't feel like you're as far away from the stable. You know what I mean? And and that's a big part of that race, as everybody knows. Going into 1989, I didn't know how to mesh with the island. I loved being on the big island of Hawaii. I hated being there for racing. And so I had this real conflict internally, like, here's this place that I love to come to and I hate being here to race. But this is where the biggest race in our sport is. And so I really had to work that year to kind of come to a place of peace where I was able to actually go there and it really feel like I could actually embrace the intensity and the power of that island, because it is very it's tangible. You can feel it when you get there. And I was kind of like the flower that wilted when I got there, and Dave was like the lion who let out of the cage, and so we were, as Dave alluded to earlier, we're very different people, and very different things give us strength. He had found his way to feel strong there. I needed to find it in 89. You're going to have to wait for the story to be written, though, to get what it was that I did.
Let's talk about that run. 2:40.04 you ran there, Mark. Dave, you were 58 seconds behind him. I think 57, 58 seconds, 2:41.03. But those times included transitions. Is that correct?
That's correct.
So nobody beat those times until Patrick Lange. That's like 27 years, 26 years. And yet with all the advances in shoe technology, in bike technology, in training and methodology and nutrition, why do you think it was that it took so long for anybody actually to get near that? And also, your finish times, based on last year's race, which was one of the fastest, ever, best conditions ever, that would have still put you fairly close to the top 10, so many years on. Why is that?
Well, I'm going to vouch for Mark for a second, Simon, since you brought it up. I have a close friend who I mentioned in this story, 89thestory.com. His name is Pat. Pat's a nuclear physicist. He's a very bright guy. He's always got his yellow pad. You know, he's always writing down the splits, and he has them all. We didn't have timing chips back then, but we had a split time in the transition. Pat has this recorded. I've reached out to him to make sure I'm accurate so that in the final stories of this story, I will have the transition. But I know it's somewhere between 121 and 137, the transition. We were pretty close, Mark and I. Came out kind of disheveled, holding my shirt or something, but we were pretty much together stride for stride. Mark's actual run time is the fastest time still. Okay. It's 238 something. You can do the math. And Patrick Longo very graciously said, you know, he had heard this story indirectly and had said to both of us that Mark still has the fastest run time. And you know, if there was accuracy, and you brought it up, and I can vouch for Mark because he beat me on the run, but I wasn't too far back. It was 238 and 239.
Wow. And Simon, you asked about, you know, there's all these new training technologies and all that. I think a lot of it is actually pointing to the effectiveness of how Dave and I actually had evolved our training to become during our career. And that maybe even though there's a lot of new advances available, they aren't necessarily enabling everybody to make huge leaps and jumps in their fitness, because actually what we did was pretty darn good, you know, to be able to post those two kind of run times on a day that, you know, in the end, the overall times were pretty darn fast as well. So I think people let me just put it this way. People think, okay, these guys are relics. That happened 30 years ago. And the way they train it's archaic, and, you know, they don't necessarily know what's the stuff now. There are a lot of great things that I wish I'd had when I was training. However, I'm not sure that everything is giving people the advantage that they think it does. And part of that is that as we approach more and more reliance on numbers, we move further and further away from just our intuition of our own bodies and understanding that and developing a real mindset of what it takes to have the best race on that one particular day. And that's something that Dave and I had to develop, because there weren't so many numbers to rely on to tell us how we were doing, if that makes sense.
Alex Hutchinson has written a book called Endure, and he's just done a presentation here at the Training Peaks Summit, and he talks about the five things that he thinks go towards great performances. And one of them was people being in a pack and how that draws out a better performance. And I think I did hear you say, Matt, that you couldn't have run that time without Dave. It was him pushing you on, being there, not wanting to be the one to break, that enabled you to sort of bring out that extra little bit that was in there, but just needed sort of something to lever it out.
Oh, there is absolutely no way I would have come close to that time had I been in that race without Dave. You know, and it's not, that race is not me winning, Dave getting second, you know, that whole thing. The real story of that race is that it was the first time that I think everybody saw that you can really race an Ironman. Up until that point, Dave was the only guy who knew that, and all the rest of us were just trying to slow down the least. You know, we were just trying to survive. Dave knew that race could be raced, and in 1989, I think we all saw that, yes, an Ironman can be raced. It has to be strategic. You, to the very last step, you have to race. And you know, to go way back, that's what Scott Zagarino saw when he thought about the race. And he would tell people in his area and people who came across about our experience of that race and what happened. And they were just mesmerized. And so, again, he's publishing these stories. And he said, you guys should collaborate on this, because there's so much that went into it that people haven't heard. And it's that granular detail that's just going to give people a real understanding of why that is one of the great legacy pieces in the sport of triathlon, in endurance racing in general, really.
I've got a question for you about sports nutrition. You mentioned Bud Light and that big blow-up can that was there. They were the sponsors of the race that year, I think. I guess that wasn't your on-course nutrition. But what did you guys, I can just imagine that actually handing out Bud Light cans at the feed stations on the bike and you making sure that you don't spray it everywhere.
That's why we went so fast, you know?
Yeah.
A light beer goes a long way. No.
But what was your sports nutrition strategy in those days?
Oh boy. A great question. I mean, I thought I was really bright way back then and would tell people, oh, you got to eat this and gobble down that. And I think probably one of the steadfast things that I've stayed in line with is don't overeat and overdrink and really listen to yourself. And Mark kind of said, you know, your intuition is quite powerful. And I think a lot of times people are programmed that they need X number of calories and a combination of gummy bears and chewy things and fluid replacement drink and on and on and on. And the excess that people have, they're not really listening to their bodies when they're performing. I found on the run that I was, despite my unsightly form, I was pretty economical and I didn't need a lot of calories. And so going through the aid stations, I would grab the fluid replacement drink, which they did have back in 89, and I'd grab an orange slice and chomp on that. I was dependent upon the aid stations for a minimal amount of nutrition, but I think both of us in our training, we developed pretty high fat oxidation rates, and we weren't really dependent upon stuffing ourselves with carbohydrates the entire time.
Mm. That's an interesting one, given the current trend to low carb, high fat.
Yeah. Well, and I've shifted all those things that I told athletes over the years in seminars and talks is that we need X amount, which should be 100% carbohydrate. It's a change over just on a dietary routine. I like to look at the ramifications health-wise for an old guy like myself, but also, you know, performance-wise as well. So, you know, quite different than what the science that we did follow back then. But again, I think a lot of it also falls back on, you know, how is my body performing at this pace? Do I have good clarity? Is my form holding together? Is my breathing rate there? You know, what is allowing me to sustain the same pace? Or do I need, you know, to gobble down something hastily without really thinking about it?
Mark, did you have anything you want to add to that, Mark? Or were you on similar pace to Dave?
You know, the sports nutrition was pretty, that was pretty archaic. I really wish that we had access to a lot of the products that athletes have now, because I think they have come up with different products that actually absorb easier. They don't cause the same gastric distress that a lot of the things that we had did. I on the run, I was pretty basic. I would have a little bit of sport drink. I had D-Fizz Coke and I had salt tablets and that was it. You know, I was like high octane. But as Dave said, I wasn't just pounding down huge amounts because my body was fairly efficient. And, when you train, you don't have aid stations, you go out and you do a long run and maybe you don't take in any kind of calories. And then all of a sudden you're an Ironman and every mile or every 2 kilometers, you've got an aid station. It's so easy to overdo it. And then everything backs up and then nothing's absorbing. And so I did try to err on the side of just, what do I need? Do I need a bunch in this aid station or do I just need a little bit or do I just need water? And that's kind of how I went through the race that year.
Okay, guys, I've got one discussion question for you, and then I've got a few quick fire ones that were sent in by some listeners. So the move, the bit that happened on what they call Mark and Dave Hill or Pay and Save or just as you come to the top of Polani. Mark, when you made that move, was that a deliberate acceleration or were you just running at the same pace and just found that Dave was suddenly a few yards behind you?
That was a very deliberate acceleration. We both knew that going up that last hill was going to be where the race was going to be made. And I'll save the details for, you know, the 1989, thestory.com. That'll be, I think, our final edition story, but it was a definite attempt to accelerate. And I tell people I sprinted, you know, as best as you can sprint at the end of an Ironman. So it was a little bit faster and it was just enough that things slowly started to pull apart. And as Dave said, you know, you're looking for that point where maybe there's a gap that opens up of just you know, 1 or 2 meters, nothing much, but it can be very significant.
Did you think you'd get him back, Dave? I know you said you were pretty good at running downhill. Did you think you'd get him back once you dropped down Palani?
Well, I did have a strategy, and my strategy, you had mentioned it near the top. It was really at the bottom, and there's a gradual gradient on Palani, and everyone recognizes this at 24 miles in the marathon of the Ironman. You're going uphill. It becomes steeper at the top before you finally make the right coming down, but it's a long grade. And my strategy was different than Mark's. So I was caught off guard by his bold move and not panic, but I need to respond and react to his, you know, aggressive sprint, as he alluded to. I don't think it was a sprint, but it was enough to open the gap. It was a fateful moment for me, recognizing that gap went from 2 meters to 3 to 4. And all of a sudden, my strategy that I had in place was now a reactionary strategy to respond to Mark's move. And I couldn't. And I knew when we reached the top of Palani Hill that he was on a magic carpet.
When I watched that video, the little YouTube video, there's points you get a sense of this huge entourage of people that are following you. It seemed to get bigger and bigger as you got towards the end. People shouting. There was sort of like a row of marshals and volunteers just behind you on bikes. And then behind that, there was people in trucks. There was people on scooters shouting at you. There's no way that would happen now. But were you aware of that? And was it a hindrance or was it a boost?
I was aware of it. I was aware that the cavalry was kind of behind us. There was a little bit of movement back and forth. I was aware of people maybe getting too close and exhausted. And then I was certainly keenly aware of voices. All of a sudden, a voice, it was a go Mark or go Dave. And at times, it was a recognizable voice both on both sides, which I will cover. And, you know, I think that part where all of a sudden, you hear this sort of golden nugget, this voice, the timeliness of a couple of them. Again, I've been a little bit evasive on this, Simon, because I think this part of the story has not been told. I had three of my close mates, buddies that were there, have been to all my races. They were there. Ironically, one was in the race. One was on the bike in that, the cavalry behind us. That part is not included in the race. And I'll just reflect very quickly. I think there are a number of things that can be done to heighten the spirit of the race and bring the crowd to the athletes without impeding or impairing the other ones that are racing. And I'll say in a lot of ways, we were lucky to have this, this roar behind us the whole time as the race unfolded, particularly in the last 5 or 6 miles.
I was aware of this huge entourage behind us, as Dave said, and even though there were voices, a lot of times it was the only thing you could hear was the sound of our feet hitting the ground and then this sort of dull motor noise from the mopeds and the cars and the trucks and everybody that was behind us. So it was this weird semi-silence, like obviously Dave and I aren't carrying on some kind of conversation, and the people half the time were completely silent because they were waiting for something to happen, and mile after mile nothing's happening. We are still running side by side by side, and back then there wasn't the communication that they have now at the finish line. There was no big jumbotron screen streaming the head of the race. The photographers at the finish line were waiting, and they had heard that one of us had broken away, but they didn't know who it was. And one of them, Rich Cruz, was there, and he said he was looking through his lens, and he had this big lens because he wanted to see who it was, and he's waiting and waiting. All of a sudden, I came into focus, and it was like... But it was just, as Dave said, a very different time. Like now the guys are out there and you could have that same race going on, but there might be a marshal and a motorcycle with the lead camera and that's it, which in some ways keeps the race a lot. It's just a different thing when the audience is following you out there. Let me put it that way.
You guys have given us a great insight into this, and I know you do want to hold something back for the stories, and we encourage everybody to go to that 1989thestory.com. And as I said at the beginning, I'll put the link in there. These are some quick fire questions, so feel free just to give me a one word answer if you like. With the benefit of hindsight and years of training, would you do anything differently to prepare for that race in 1989?
Nope.
No, Dave? No, I wouldn't know how to prepare differently.
Okay. To both of you then. So Dave, you're going first with this one. Was this your greatest triathlon performance? And if not, which one was?
I think at the time, history has told us, because it evolved. And as Mark said, we didn't know this was going to be this epic battle. Mm. We were just in this race. It was the flow of the race. And now what people had depicted as the real battle between Mark Allen and Dave Scott was now coming true. And as it unfolded, I'm just thinking, okay, I do have this, my nemesis is right next to me and I'm going to beat him. And I didn't have any idea how fast we were going or what we were doing. I didn't wear a watch, never do any of my splits. I didn't have a power meter. I just said, I'm racing, and I'm racing Mark Allen, and I'm going to beat him at the end. So, when I look back at the race, and Mark has mentioned this many, many times, could I have gone faster? Yeah, if Mark was not there, I don't think so. I don't think so, because the impetus to beat him became stronger and stronger each mile. Therefore, I had to collect myself and dig deeper, deeper, deeper so that I could do it. So I think, to answer your question, I did a race in 94. The circumstances, 5 years later, I came back. I was second when I was 40. It was a wonderful time for me. I had two kids then, and I remember that race very, very well. Circumstances were totally different. Pressure was a lot different. So in a long-winded answer, I'd say probably yes, Simon.
Mark?
For me, it was probably one of two great races. That day was so special because it took 7 years to put together, and just the way that race evolved, Dave and I were in this envelope together that was almost like neither of us could be touched by the rest of the universe, and so there was something completely magical about that. And in many ways, that day went absolutely perfectly for me. But my final win in 1995, I had so many moments where I wanted to quit. I came off the bike 13 and a half minutes behind Thomas Hellriegel, and I was an old guy, and there was so much of myself I had to overcome on that day to post that final sixth win in Kona. Then in some ways that was equally as great, but in a very, very, for very, very different reasons. And, sometimes the greatest races are the ones where you just overcome yourself over and over and over. The greatest victories are those ones over that part of yourself that would have wanted to quit. And people don't see those victories. And so was this the greatest race? For sure. It was the greatest race. Was it my greatest race? It was one of two, for sure.
1989 was also the famous Rick and Dick Hoyt year. Were you aware of those guys at all during the race? Did you see them finish at the end? And have you ever caught up with them afterwards about that race?
No, I never saw them. Yes, I was aware of their presence in the race. I have spoken to them many, many times, but I didn't really talk to them about their 89 race.
Mark?
I had heard of their story. I hadn't met them yet. I was so exhausted after that race. I didn't go back to the finish line. So I didn't see their finish until I actually watched the show on the television broadcast. But a number of years later, I've had a number of conversations with them. Yeah, they're pretty inspiring.
After 1989, did you ever race Ironman again together?
That was it.
That's a great question, because Mark had these six wins. I came back in 94. He didn't race. He won in 95, which you just talked about. I came back at 42 in 96. And Mark had decided, and he can speak for himself, that 95 was his last race. So I kind of sandwiched him in 2 years, 94 and 96. And I thought, even with my comeback at 40 in 1994, Mark would be at the starting line. And again, my motivations were a lot different than they were in the 80s. I just wanted to have this sterling race for Dave Scott. And if Mark or Greg Welch or any of the other top guys were there, and I didn't know if I was going to be there, then, I know how to race. So I thought this, it could unfold to be a great race again.
Dave, this one's for you. When Mark finally beat you in 1989, did you get angry with that? Or did you have a sense of relief that, oh, thank goodness he's done it, you know, and now that's a sort of monkey off my back?
I never thought the latter, no. Thank God he beat me. I feel great about that. What kind of nonsense is that? So,
yeah, well, that's not my question. That was a reader question.
Gee whiz, I didn't feel good about that at all. What a silly question. No, I think anyone who loses a big battle like this, I was disappointed. And, you know, reflective on, as you do in every race, not thinking that this might be the last time I'm going to race, Mark. It was, boy, I could have done this a little bit differently, and therefore maybe the outcome might have been different. But no, I didn't want to give up that by any means. I will share one funny thing. I was looking because Scott Zagarino has requested pictures, and I was thinking about my son who was just born. Ryan was born in August of 89. He was there at the race. So there's some shots back in our condo. It looks like I'm still wearing the same green shorts that I raced Mark in. And I'm kind of huddling over Ryan thinking, you know, I didn't really think about this race at all. I've got my son right here. I'm hoping I took a shower in their different shorts. But, I didn't want to – I hated losing that race, you know. And I came across and I lost the race and – and I knew at that point on the hill, reaching the top of Plani Hill, that Mark had won. You know, that had a big walnut in my gut, to say the least. But I wasn't, you know, afterwards, I think, to be angry at my competitor, to be angry at myself is not the right notion. And I didn't feel that way. I've felt resolved that I got beat. I got beat on a great day. Mark had a phenomenal race. Could I have done things differently? Maybe. And maybe there'll be an opportunity.
Final question then, chaps. You've been asked about this race probably every day of your life for 30 years. Do you ever get tired of talking about it?
Not really, because every time I talk about it, it's always a little different. And it's taken 30 years to actually really understand a lot of what went into it. And you know, in the beginning, I didn't even think of it as an epic race. I just kind of looked at it like, wow, I finally had a great race. But it's taken 30 years to kind of have it take on context. You know, that the time was very fast, and there haven't been a lot of times that have been faster. There's never been a side by side to the very bitter end battle like Dave and I had that day. And what it took for me personally to get in the kind of shape, to have the stars line up, to, you know, have a lot of things go my way that ended up enabling me to have that race on that day, I didn't really see or understand or know until, you know, these years have gone by and I think back on it and reflect, and somebody asked me a question. It's like, oh, well, actually, let me explain what really happened. And so that's kind of what we're doing with these stories, is explaining what really happened 30 years later.
Dave?
I think Mark answered that pretty darn well. You know, the seeds of the race were really developed inside of both of us. And people know it on the outside and what they viewed, but they don't really know the dynamics of what went on. And I think, you know, this is the first opportunity that we've really had to, as I said earlier, kind of expose all of that. And you know, at times in writing it, it's difficult thinking about it because it brings it back 30 years ago, because now I can see things and I'm reminded of it. You know, I've reached out to my friends. I said, what do you remember? And so they add a little snippet here and there. And I said, oh, yes, that's right. So that part of it, when your question, Simon, when we're asked about it, I don't have any trouble 30 years later telling them a bit more.
Well, that's great. I really appreciate you two guys being on the show today. It's been a fantastic chat. As you said, there's so much more to come. So we would recommend that everybody goes to 1989 at thestory.com. But for now, Dave Scott, Mark Allen, thank you very much for being on the show. Really appreciate the conversation.
We'll see you in Connor.
Right then, that's a wrap for this week. thanks again for listening. As always, I appreciate that you have plenty of choice out there in podcast land, so it does mean an awful lot to me when you come back regularly. If you enjoyed the podcast, please could you hop onto iTunes or Podbean and leave a rating and a comment if you can. Apparently, it's really good for the ratings, although to be absolutely honest with you, I have no idea how they work these things out. If you like the way I roll and you find some synergy with my approach to life and sport, maybe be interested in joining my SWAT Inner Circle training group. If you are, please just email beth@thetriathloncoach.com for more details. You can also use that email address to ask for my special free gift, which I have for you, which are my top 25 tips on how to be a high-performance human. Okay, that's all for this week. I'll be back next week with another great guest. So for now, enjoy the rest of your week.